for coming today. We're going to go ahead and start our class on Proverbs. Today we're going to pick up in chapter 25. The theme of today's class is spiritual wisdom in relationships. This section of Proverbs that we're going to start was actually an addendum to the original book of Proverbs. The original book of Solomon's Proverbs ends after chapter 24. Solomon wrote over 3,000 Proverbs in his lifetime, as we're told in the book of Kings, only a small fraction of which are collected in this book. A couple hundred years after Solomon, King Hezekiah supervised these last seven chapters being added to the book of Proverbs. There's five more chapters of Solomon's Proverbs, which apparently had been published but not included in the inspired book of the Proverbs. So, guided by the Spirit, King Hezekiah added several more chapters of Solomon's Proverbs, as well as chapters 30 and 31, which are mostly written by anonymous authors. The slight difference with these last few chapters is they're a little bit more concentrated in terms of the topics. Solomon's main collection of Proverbs tends just to go from one subject to another and just collect a lot of different things for you to think about. These last few chapters tend to focus a little bit more specifically as a kind of like a theme running through them for a lot of the time. What we'll see a lot in chapters 25 to 27 is there's a lot of things about relationships. Chapter 25 talks about relationships with your neighbor and relationships with rulers. Chapter 26 will bring us back to some familiar acquaintances, the sluggard, the gossip, the practical joker, a lot of things like this. And chapter 27 will kind of contrast friends and other possessions. There is some other material in there of a slightly miscellaneous nature, so as usual we won't have a time to cover every single verse, but this will give you an idea of what we're going to do today. Phil is going to lead us in a time of prayer. Phil has a great deal to be thankful for. His favorite baseball team, the Pirates, have been in first place for an extended period of time, and as this is a rather rare event at this point of the summer, Phil is very happy and thankful, so he will be a good person to lead us in prayer.
Neighbors, our enemies, those that we love, our family. Thank you for the power of being in first place.
Amen. If someone other than the Reds or Tigers has to win, it might as well be the Pirates. That would be cool. That would be fun to see a downtrodden team like that finally come back and score a victory. Proverbs chapter 25, picking up at the beginning of the chapter. Karen, could you get us started off here? Read verses 1 to 7 for us. And Lloyd, could you go from 8 to 15? I think we'll just stop there for the time being. Oh, you can read that one too if you want.
Yeah, it is Proverbs. Okay. Which verses again?
25? 25, 1 to 7.
These are more Proverbs of Solomon, copied by the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, to search out a matter is the glory of kings. As the heavens are high and the earth is deep, so the hearts of kings are unsearchable. Remove the dross from the silver, and out comes the material for the silversmith. Remove the wicked from the king's presence, and his throne will be established through righteousness. Do not exalt yourself in the king's presence, and do not claim a place among great men. It's better for him to say to you, come up here, than for him to humiliate you before a noble. What you have seen is dirt.
You ain't wrong with Norma too much.
I know, it's the worst place, isn't it? Yeah, for this.
Go for it.
What you have seen with your eyes, do not bring hastily to court. For what will you do in the end if your neighbor puts you to shame? If you argue your case with a neighbor, do not betray another man's confidence. For he who hears it may shame you, and you will never lose your bad reputation. A word aptly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver. Like an earring of gold or an ornament of fine gold is a wise man's rebuke to a listening ear. Like the coolness of snow at harvest time is a trustworthy messenger to those who send him. He refreshes the spirit of his masters. Like clouds and wind without rain is a man who boasts of gifts he does not give. Through patience a ruler can be persuaded, and a gentle tongue can break a bone.
Okay, we'll stop there because there's plenty of things to talk about in that passage right there. The theme behind a lot of these proverbs is the idea that in this life we're going to know a lot of different people. We're going to have a lot of people who just vaguely fall into that category of our neighbors, the people around us, people that you meet, people that you know, maybe close to, maybe not. And then at times you also have to deal with rulers, with kings, with people in positions of authority. And so it just gives us a few ideas on how to deal with that. And a lot of these combine, especially the proverbs on the king, the proverbs on the king often combine earthly advice on how to deal with people in positions of authority with spiritual parallels. Because ideally, an earthly leader should be a reflection of God's own qualities. Ideally, an earthly leader should have those. In practice, it doesn't happen so much, but you can still use the relationships that we have with people in positions of authority to kind of get some insight into your relationship with God as well. I titled that the little sub-passage, With the Rich and Mighty. That's actually a quote from an old movie. It stars one of Phil Staffa's favorites, Jimmy Stewart, in the movie called The Philadelphia Story. Phil does not like Jimmy Stewart, and it's a strange thing because you think an all-American person like Phil would like Jimmy Stewart, but that just shows you. You know, I go around occasionally quoting disreputable people like Leon Trotsky and Emma Goldman, but Phil doesn't like Jimmy Stewart, so I ask you, which is more un-American? Anyway, there's this movie with Jimmy Stewart where he plays this writer who's sent to cover this big society wedding, and he is kind of treated like dirt by all these rich people and famous people, and he has a quote that he says several times in the movie. He brought his photographer around with him, and she's a good friend of his, and she admires him, and he gets treated like dirt, and she says, how do you let them treat you like that? And he says, it's an old saying of mine, with the rich and mighty, always a little patience. And that's kind of the theme of the movie. And it's kind of a theme of what this is giving us in terms of earthly advice with the people who are the rulers of the world. The hearts of kings are unsearchable. Don't exalt yourself in the king's presence. And the point behind that, besides the little bit of practical advice, is also to realize that God is far above any earthly ruler. Certainly, these sayings to those of you who may have a position of authority or leadership are well worth taking into account. The idea that the true responsibility of an earthly ruler is not to boss people around, but as he says, to search a matter out is the glory of kings. To be able to understand what's going on, to be able to seek out the needs of your people, the example that Jesus set. That's what a true leader is all about. A true leader is not about telling people what to do, but about seeking out the truth, looking to understand things. And even though most of the rich and mighty of this earth require more than a little patience for us to deal with them, God, as the true mighty king of the universe, he does have that quality. It's a reminder to us that what God asks for in a human leader, he's more than happy to supply himself. God is not interested in lording it over us or shoving us around. God is very willing to seek out what's in our hearts, to seek out our needs. The spiritual parallels, of course, are useful whether or not we find the practical advice helpful. It also tells us, if you read verse 6 and 7, you might realize that this kind of anticipates one of Jesus' parables. It says, don't exalt yourself in the king's presence. Don't claim a place among great men. It's better for him to say to you, come up here, than for him to humiliate you. Remember this parallel that Jesus says in chapter 14 of Luke. This is the one that Karen was so eager to read for us. Jesus said very much the same thing. He said, when you go to visit at a banquet or a dinner, he says, don't immediately assume that you should have one of the high places, because what's going to happen? Because I'll probably say, that wasn't for you. That's for this guy over here. But instead, be satisfied with the lowly place, because they may just say, hey, friend, got a better place for you. And that's good advice, both in terms of our dealings with the world and in terms of our dealing with God. We're moving on to towards the middle of the chapter, where it talks more about our relationships with equals, with our neighbors, with our friends, with those around us. The The scripture says to love your neighbor. And you might remember the episode in the Gospels where one of the teachers of the law wanted to nail that down a little bit. Okay, who is my neighbor? And so Jesus told him at one of his most famous parables.
To justify himself.
Remember what parable Jesus told to illustrate that? What we call the parable of the Good Samaritan, that said, your neighbor's anybody who needs you. Your neighbor's anybody who needs some help. And of course, we know in practice that's a nice sentiment, but in theory it's a nice sentiment. In practice, sometimes it takes some real patience too. Sometimes we have to exert some real patience with our neighbors, but that's what we're called to do. There's an old Ambrose Bierce quote, "A neighbor is someone who we are commanded to love as ourselves and who does everything possible to make us disobedient." Because sometimes that's the way that our neighbors are. But Jesus didn't say, love your neighbor if he's easy to get along with. He just said, love your neighbor as yourself. And that's some of the things that Proverbs is talking about. This verse that starts in verse 7 and moves on to the next couple of things. You know, what you've seen with your eyes, don't bring it hastily to court. Verse 9, if you argue your case with a neighbor, don't betray another man's confidence. In other words, there's a level of trust, a level of basic interpersonal faith that is expected from us as believers, whether or not it's reciprocated, whether or not the people around us are doing something disreputable, whether or not they're doing something sinful. There's a certain level of basic respect and trust that God wants us to give people, even if we think they don't deserve it, because that's what we want from other people, and you and I don't deserve it from other people. We don't deserve it any more than anyone else does, but that's something we need, and God always asks us to do that. So he asks us to give the treasure of simple spiritual fruit. And what he's trying to help us to see is that if you learn to base your relationships with other people on good spiritual fruit, being trustworthy, being reliable, you know, verse 13, like the coolness of snow at harvest time is a trustworthy messenger to those who send him. He refreshes the spirit of his masters. It's just a refreshing thing. When you have a friend you know you can count on, whether it's just to do something for you reliably or to tell you the truth when you need it, it's refreshing, it's calming, it's soothing. And he contrasts that in verse 14, like clouds and wind without rain is a man who boasts of gifts he does not give. In other words, you're going through a drought and you're thirsty and your crops are withering up and there's this promising looking rain cloud come along and all it does is just float on by. It doesn't do anything for you. That's the kind of friend who's always telling you what he's going to do and never does it. Always telling you how much he cares about you and then when you need him, he's not there. That's a parallel also, this verse that I wrote up here in Jude. Jude calls certain people clouds without rain and springs that don't produce any water. You know, that we tend to promise more than we actually do, and God is calling us to kind of turn that around. And one of the things that he's pointing out in these verses is if you learn to be that kind of a friend, you will develop some very good friendships with people. People like that kind of person. Even if they're a person that you don't initially get along with, you'll be able to develop some much better relationships that way. The old writer Robert Louis Stevenson used to say, a friend is a gift that you give to yourself. In other words, that friends just don't pop up. You've got to give that gift to yourself. You've got to give something. You've got to show that person that you're a worthy friend, and then they see that in you, and then even if they may not have liked you at first, even if you might not have liked them first, if you just get in the habit of being kind and giving and trustworthy, then you may find some pretty surprising friendships. You may develop some friendships that are pretty valuable that way. The last part of the chapter, we'll just kind of synopsize it. The last part talks a lot about self-control in our relationships. And if you look at verse 16, it says, if you find honey, eat just enough. Too much of it, and you'll vomit. Seldom set foot in your neighbor's house. Too much of you, and he will hate you. It's an interesting little parable. And a lot of the parables, or a lot of the proverbs in this section are a little bit crude like that. It's kind of letting you know, show a little self-control. Have reasonable expectations of other people. That's what he's talking about. In your relationships with your peers, with your neighbors and friends, you'll be trustworthy, be reliable, be forgiving, and here he adds on here, have reasonable expectations of people. It kind of goes both ways. You know, we want to have friends who are available when we need them. they're expecting the same thing of us. And we all need to have reasonable expectations of everyone. It's one of the things that can ruin relationships quicker than anything else is if you put unreasonable expectations on somebody. He says it's like eating too much honey. You like it, you want it, you can't as the old potato chip ad says, you can't have just one. You got to just keep pigging out on it. But what happens eventually? It just kind of doesn't work too well, does it? In the literal example, your digestive system expresses its opinions on what you're doing. In the spiritual parallel, if you put too much of an imposition on your neighbor, it can ruin your relationship. Loving others as ourselves is, of course, one of the basic foundations of so much else that comes in the scriptures. A lot of Romans 12 talks about this. Romans 13 says something very similar to what Jesus said. Romans 13 says, love does no harm to its neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. And it's something that Jesus himself emphasized repeatedly. If you just love people, if you just learn to love people, then you'll automatically take care of a lot of other things. You don't need a lot of commands. You don't need a lot of rules. You don't need to be bossing each other around that much if you just take care of that. I'm getting the signal from the bench to move on to the next chapter. So we will move to chapter 26. Speaking of having reasonable expectations. Chapter 26, we're going to renew some familiar acquaintances. We're going to meet one of our favorite characters in Proverbs, the sluggard, towards the middle of the chapter. We will meet one of Proverbs' frequent guests, the fool, in the first part of the chapter. Picking up here in Proverbs chapter 26, Isaac, you look ready to go back there. Could you read the first 12 verses of chapter 26 for us? Thank you very much. The theme of that passage is the concept, it's talking about fools. One of Proverbs' is frequent subject, comparing folly with wisdom. The person who lives his life according to spiritual wisdom, the person who lives according to worldly wisdom, which is truthfully in God's eyes just folly. And he has this interesting phrase. These fools are going around, but do they think they're fools? No, they are wise in their own eyes. This is the theme that comes out of this, is he's cautioning us about those of us and those that we meet who are wise in their own eyes. And he says there's more hope for a fool than for such a person. And he talks about as well, that's one of the hazards in dealing with fools. And this is kind of like a little family resemblance. A couple weeks ago we studied a lot of Proverbs about the sluggard, and the fool is really a close relationship with the sluggard. You have the fool, and then in the middle of the chapter we'll look at sluggards. And then we'll look at practical jokers, and then we'll look at some other members of the family, concluding with gossips. And it's kind of an insidious family relationship that all these people don't really take any true responsibility in their relationships. It's kind of like families of different animals. There's a lot of animals that are related to each other that you wouldn't naturally expect. My wife, who is a very devoted fan of the local group of post-adolescents who practice with the prolate spheroid, is very excited about the fact that prolate spheroid season will be beginning next month. That's college football, to those of you who do not remember your analytical geometry. Once it gets to be prolate spheroid time, there are certain animals which the public in this part of the world turns against. Wolverines, for example. Badgers being another example. Do you know what family, just to show my willingness to play along with the local religion here, do you know what family of animals wolverines and badgers belong to?
Weasels.
They're weasels. Wolverines, badgers, otters, minks, ermines, skunks, they're actually all weasels. They don't have necessarily the obvious relationship when you first think about them, but they actually, if you think about them, there's a certain set of characteristics, a certain attitude, if you will, that characterizes all those members of the weasel family. Well, Proverbs teaches us that fools, sluggards, gossips, practical jokers, other people like that, they have a family relationship too. They just don't take any responsibility for what they do or what they say. And it's a basic teaching of Scripture that whatever faults we may have, whatever defects we may have in our beliefs or our understanding, they're more than remedied if we just take responsibility. If you just take responsibility for your actions, your beliefs, let them be your own instead of something that you let yourself get blown and tossed by every wind of the world, then that makes a big difference. And so this passage of Proverbs kind of teaches us a couple different things. It kind of cautions us not to be a fool or a sluggard or a gossip, and it also helps us as best we can to deal with them. But it also is very honest that this is kind of an unavoidable dilemma, because as he says in verse 11, and this is echoed in 2 Peter, as a dog returns to its vomit, what does a fool do? It just repeats his folly. And there's actually an even better verse in the next chapter, chapter 27, verse 22. Linda likes this because it's kind of a scientific analogy. Though you grind a fool in a mortar, grinding him like grain with a pestle, you will not remove his folly from him. So if you're dealing with a fool, what is that telling you? It tells you don't try so hard to change that person. All you can do is tell them the truth. You can't change a fool. A lot of our practical wisdom in the world tends to come down to the fact that we're always trying to change somebody else instead of just changing our own attitudes and learning to adapt to things a little bit better. And there's two verses in Proverbs that make this point perfectly, verses 4 and 5 of chapter 26. It's talking about dealing with a fool according to his folly. It says in verse 4, how do you treat a fool who's being foolish? Don't answer him according to his folly. In other words, if this fool wants to argue with you about something stupid, don't argue. If a fool wants you to get all emotional and upset about something, don't do it, because what'll happen if you do? Then you make yourself a fool. Well, that sounds easy enough. Look at the next verse, though. What does it say? You better answer a fool according to his folly, or else what'll happen? He'll go away wise in his own eyes. If he wants to spout off about his silly opinions and all the things that they ought to be doing differently and all the things that you ought to be doing differently, and he wants you to get all upset about this, and you just say, well, that's okay, it doesn't really bother me, what's he going to do? I care more than this person. I'm right. He can't answer my arguments. I'm pretty intelligent here. Well, what is it saying? It's saying it kind of presents you with an unavoidable dilemma, doesn't it? Now, the implication is that you can't control what this fool does. Now, what's the lesser of those two evils?
Walking away,
isn't it? If the fool wants to be wise in his own eyes, well, what did that other verse in Proverbs say? You can't stop him. You're not going to stop. All you can do is decide whether you're going to be like him yourself or whether you're just going to let him go along and hope that someday God will take care of him. You know, there's an old show. Remember the A-Team? The old show from those of you who survived the 80s as I did? Remember Mr. T on that show? When someone was really being stupid and when someone was really being annoying and doing something that really was getting everybody else upset and everyone else wanted to blow the guy up, what did Mr. T always say? Pity the fool. Just pity him. Because they're causing as much harm and nuisance as they cause to everybody else, they're hurting themselves more than everybody else. And there's such an attitude that we get, even as Christians, of being very condescending towards people that we think aren't doing very well. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing. You must have liked that show. I didn't realize you were a fan of that show. I didn't realize that.
I didn't realize Mr. T was so wise.
That's right. It is wisdom, isn't it? It is wisdom, isn't it? Of a sort that we tend to look down on. Just the pure ability to say, I pity the fool, instead of getting yourself all worked up. It's a lot of wisdom, isn't it? And that's a very good thing. That's a very good thing to remember when we're going to get a little bit worked up, because we tend to be very snooty about people. There's an old story about Dorothy Sayers, the writer, when she was at, or Dorothy Parker rather. I confuse those two because I like them both. Dorothy Parker, the writer, was at a party with a lot of people, and there was this famous person there who was kind of behaving very snootily. Everyone was having a good time. It was a holiday, and he was kind of annoyed that people weren't paying much attention to him, and so he was kind of standing off by himself, just kind of, you know, glaring at everybody else. And Dorothy Parker said, "Oh, glad you're here, but you don't seem to be having a very good time." And he said, "It's just that I can't bear fools." And she said, "Yeah, that's really funny, because I know for a fact your mother certainly could." There's nothing wrong with enduring fools and even loving them, learning to show some appreciation for them, because God's policy is not to slap fools around. God's policy is not to correct them instantly. It's to patiently show them over and over again the effects of their folly, which they suffer from more than anybody else does, and not to get so worked up about it. And sometimes God will let them experience the consequences of their folly. It's like Herbert Spencer used to say, if you go around trying to protect every fool from the consequences of his folly, all it does is fill the world with more fools. That's all it does. They just don't ever learn. Would you like to add something, Karen?
Yeah, just a quick something.
Are you a Mr. T fan too, by the way?
Yeah, I know the 80s.
Okay, good. Yeah, yeah. An awful lot of times, Jesus faced some really foolish people, and he was very kind as best he could.
I mean, I'm just saying, like the woman at the well, where she had, you know, she was trying to get into this debate, but he would always
exactly
kind of come at her with another question that would redirect her.
That's a very good example, because that woman at the well didn't get what Jesus was saying at all. She wanted to know these irrelevant things.
Yeah.
She has these irrelevant questions, and her personal life was a mess. One option available to Jesus was just to rip her to pieces. You come here, you've had five husbands, your life's a mess, you're immoral, you're sleazy, and you're a fool. You ask me these dumb questions. Who cares, these answers to these religious debates? You got the Son of God here, and you're too dumb even to notice it. He could have just ripped her to pieces and made her feel terrible. But how did he make her feel?
Love.
He made her feel love. He made her feel wonderful. He made her feel so good about who she was talking to, she went off and told a whole town full of people. That's a very good example. I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's a very good example of how God deals with fools, even though God is much more aware of how foolish they are than we are. And the same thing goes for our next group of friends, the sluggard. Here's our favorite. And this is kind of verses 13 to 16. Some of these have been elsewhere in Proverbs, but Hezekiah apparently liked this little set of passages, because this is like this little collection is kind of like the sluggard's greatest hits. You know, it has all the famous sayings about the sluggard. The sluggard says, "Oh, there's a lion in the road, a fierce lion out there. I can't go outside now. I can't go to work now. Someone told me there's a lion out there. I'll get attacked. As a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on its bed." Just back and forth, not going anywhere. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. "Oh, this looks tasty. Oh, that looks so good. Oh, if only someone would help me bring this back to my mouth so I could eat it. Oh, this is so good." You know, all the ways that we get things half started and get something underway and get excited about it, and then just the sheer physical exertion involved just overwhelms us. Verse 16, here's the famous phrase again. "The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who answer discreetly." That's the thing about the sluggard. He's making all these excuses about lions out in the street, all these excuses, he doesn't realize that they're just silly. He's wise in his own eyes. "I'm wise to stay here safely in my little bed, turning back and forth, instead of going out there and risk getting eaten by a lion. And these other people who are advising me to go out, oh, they're just fools, aren't they?" This is kind of the common theme, again, that comes with this family. Just not taking responsibility. And that's a key word right there that is good to remember. Not taking responsibility for fixing everybody else, but taking responsibility for what? For our own attitudes, our own feelings towards other people, our own actions, the opportunities you and I have to help other people. But see, it's human nature. What responsibilities do we want to take? Responsibility for other people's lives. Here's what you ought to be doing. Here's what the church ought to be doing. Here's what the government ought to be doing. Yeah, here's the way to fix everything like that. Well, one of the reasons why people are so eager to do that is because they really don't want to get down to taking care of their own attitudes, their own problems in their heart, because that's a lot harder. And that doesn't have that payoff that worldly people think. So excuses versus responsibility, and responsibility understood in the proper way. So responsibility tends to intimidate people because we tend to think of responsibility in terms of, I got to fix this problem. I got to fix that person over there. I got to fix the church. I got to fix the country. But God's sense of responsibility that he wants to instill in us is much different. Just take responsibility for your attitudes towards people. Take responsibility when you have a chance to pick someone up a little bit, then that's all you need to do. Well, there's another passage in here, another member of the family who is a little more unpleasant than some of these other characters, and that's the gossip. And gossip is yet another thing that we should caution ourselves about. You know, in 1 Corinthians 5, this very severe passage about people in the church who are going to have to face some severe discipline by the rest of the church, we're used to thinking that in terms of people who do something spectacularly immoral, people who do some spectacular sin. But one of the things included in there is slanderers, you know, people who go around saying nasty things about people. And the gossip, verse 20, without woods, a fire goes out. Without gossip, a quarrel dies down. But the problem is, verse 22, the words of a gossip are like choice morsels that go down to a man's inmost parts. The attraction to gossip or rumor, speculation, this is what that verse is talking about. We love it. This is why the news media is such a big industry in our country. There's a huge proportion of what passes for news in our society is nothing of the sort. It's gossip and rumor and speculation and stirring up hatred, stirring up anger, stirring up fear. But the reason why it's ubiquitous is because people love it. People love that kind of thing because it sure beats having to sit back and think about human nature. It sure beats having to genuinely love my neighbor. It sure beats having to learn how to practice grace. It sure beats being generous to people who need it. It sure beats all those things, sitting and listening to a lot of gossip and speculation and rumor and who's done something horrible, who said something horrible, who I can hate today, who I can argue with today. That's sure a lot more fun than putting godly values into practice, isn't it? And that's why the words of the gospel go down to the inmost being. They're like choice morsels. You know, the Germans have a word for that. And if you study German history, it won't surprise you. They have a word that called Schadenfreude. It's a German word that means enjoying pain. And if you know German history, you know why they have a word for it, because Germans enjoy other people's pain. And it's a concept that really cuts into a very unpleasant part of human nature, that there's a joy that comes with knowing someone else's suffering or knowing people are arguing or upset and wanting to share that. And it's something as Christians, it's very important that we learn to recognize it and to deal with it. We can't, not in other people, not going around making one more thing for you to criticize other people for, but learning to truly care about other people and to take joy with people who have joy and mourn with people who mourn, as Romans said. You want to add something, Joy? Got a scripture?
Well, no, it's just my translation is interesting because it's different. It says, instead of saying it's choice morsels, it says the words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down into your innermost parts.
That's an interesting translation because it's equally true, isn't it? It's equally true. Gossip can harm a lot more than we think it does. And when we engage in it, it harms other people, and again, it harms yourself too. It harms yourself even if it's delicious, even if it feels very enticing. And so that's a good point to make as well. So setting behind this family, the weasel family, if you like, all these wolverines and badgers that we encounter, but you know, we're supposed to learn to love these people and not to become like them, and learn instead to recognize the warning signals when we see them. See, we tend to view getting angry or being frightened as an emotion to be indulged for its own sake. But they're actually warning signals from God. Same thing with guilt. Guilt isn't something we're supposed to be left wallowing in. It's a warning signal from God. Something's wrong. And that's what we should do instead of indulging in these emotions, is just say, okay, this is a tip-off that I need to readjust my perspective here. this is a tip off. I really need to readjust the way I'm thinking about these things. And that's where this last passage comes in. We'll try to do as much of this as we can. Friends and possessions, Proverbs 27. This is a passage that talks about the things that matter in our life the most. Verse 27, let's at least try to read the first part of this. Doc, could you read verses 1 to 8 of chapter 27 for us? It'll give us a little bit to talk about. Great, thanks a lot. And we'll synopsize some of the rest of it since we're running a little short on time, and the notes have some more ideas for you. This is talking about our blessings. We have different kind of blessings in this world. Some are very lasting, some are very fleeting. You have blessings of friends that you can know all your life. You have blessings of material things that you have for a little while. Some things you're going to be able to take with you. The grace of God, the love of God, the security, spiritual security. You can take those with you at the end of your life. Most of the things that you have in this world you can't take with you at the end of your life. So this passage kind of talks about just our blessings in general, and most specifically our friends and our possessions. And these first eight verses warn us about squandering our blessings. And the rest of the chapter talks about preserving your blessings and recognizing them. The squandering your blessings can be done in a lot of ways. You can do it by the things you say or the things you don't say. Verses 1 and 2, this guy that goes around boasting, praising himself, that's a pretty good way to squander the blessings that God has given you. But then he also talks about hiding your love, not speaking when you should. So speech and silence both need to be used appropriately. That's another Proverbs perennial, the use of tongue. He talks about deceit. He talks about you can trust wounds from a friend, but an enemy multiplies kisses. That kind of goes with verse 5. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. You may have an enemy who fawns over you, who tells you all the things you want to hear, and you may have a friend who maybe doesn't have the social grace. Maybe you're even embarrassed with your friend, but your friend you can count on. And what he's saying is, get beyond those appearances a little bit. Get beyond the appearances in your relationships and with your blessings to see who really has your best interests at heart. And then he has this image in verse 8. Always like to point out these animal metaphors. Like a bird that strays from its nest is a man who strays from his home. It's talking about knowing what you have and not getting impatient. Knowing when you've got it good. There's a part of us that is always looking for more. The old grass is always greener scenario. And it says even a little baby bird knows when it's got its good. It knows when it's got a nice safe nest and it's got parents who love it, bringing it food. And it knows better than to leave that nest before its time. But you and I don't know that better. We don't know better than that. Because we're always looking for something more. We're always getting restless. We don't appreciate what we have. It's like that old poem by A.E. Housman, The Land of Lost Content. That is the land of lost content. I see it shining plain, the happy highways where I once went and can't go back again. The way that we tend to burn our bridges, we get so enticed by something out there and we leave behind the things that we should appreciate and spoil our relationships and miss out on things, then you can never go back once you do. It's like trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube. And this is what it's warning us. And there's another old, I won't go into the lengthy incident because it'll bore you to tears, but there's in ancient Rome there was this guy named Catiline who was kind of a notorious person. Some people really loved him because he was a great flatterer and schmoozer. And a few people of his time, like Cicero, saw him for what he was. He was a schemer who was trying to seize control of the government. And there's a poet named Sallust who saw through him also. And Sallust, and his after Catiline had been exposed as a fink, he kind of said, Catiline is the kind of guy that because he was always envying everyone else's possessions, he always wasted his own. It's a very wise comment, because when we're envious of things we don't have, what does it show? That you don't appreciate what you already have. And that's true of your interactions with your friends and neighbors. It's true of what we have in our society. It's true of what you have in the church. That if you're too busy envying things you don't have, then you're going to squander the things you do have. Preserving your blessings, middle of the chapter, verse 10, don't forsake your friend. Verse 12, the prudent see danger and take refuge. It talks about verse 14, don't bless your neighbor loudly in the morning, or it'll be taken as a curse. And it talks about this, just, you know, this famous verse, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. But what that's talking about is not really perfecting our earthly talents or accomplishing results. It's talking about helping each other to live by mutual aid, instilling in each other not a sense of competition and accomplishment and developing things that will impress the worldly, but of instilling in each other a sense of God's grace and compassion. And looking ahead, this verse when it says, where it talks about the prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep going and suffering for it. So in other words, preserve the blessings you have. Recognize the blessings you have and then preserve them. And that's the last part of this chapter, talks about appreciating what you have. It says, death and destruction, verse 20, are never satisfied, and neither are the eyes of man. It's just human nature not to be satisfied with what you've got. But you've got a lot, especially if you're a believer in God. And it's important to understand the spiritual blessings that God gives you so you can learn to be satisfied with them. If you remember the famous medical missionary Albert Schweitzer, he was famous because he wore the same hat for 40 years, and he wore the same necktie for 20 years. And one time, Jack Parr, whom some of you old-timers will remember, he was a TV reporter and talk show host, and he went to interview Dr. Schweitzer one time, and he said, "Yeah, I got to ask you, you know, do you realize that there are people who have dozens of hats and dozens of neckties, don't you? I mean, don't you ever get tired of wearing, why do you only have one hat and one necktie?" He said, "Well, it's because I only got one head and one neck. That's all I need. What do I need all this other stuff for? Can't use more than one at a time." Learning to be satisfied is a spiritual blessing. And this is what he's talking about. And this last part, I won't read it because we've got to move on to the trivia, but this last few verses where it says, talks about your flocks and your fields, that if you have what you need, be grateful for it. Be content with it. Don't think so much about the things you don't have, but realize that every day you get up in the morning, you've got enough to eat, which some people don't. You've got a place to stay, which many people don't. You've got friends, who many people don't. And be appreciative of that before you go start thinking about all the things that you haven't got. And be appreciative when things touch you in the world, when the world upsets you, when the world starts to get you afraid or jealous or resentful. That's not a feeling you should indulge. That's just a warning sign. It's a reminder to adjust your perspective to a more gracious and more godly and more compassionate perspective. That's where we come to our trivia. This is animals and history trivia, so combining two great categories. Besides dogs, what animals were commonly used in ancient Rome as guard animals to protect homes and other buildings? Five choices, and they're all good ones, all good animals. Do you think that the ancient Romans used crocodiles to protect their homes? Do you think they used hawks? Do you think they used cheetahs? Do you think they used foxes? Or do you think they used geese?
Geese.
That could happen.
Well, this goes back to a famous incident in Roman history in 390 BC when Rome was at war with the Gauls. Rome had a war with the Gauls, and it was going badly, and they lost this big battle at the River of Allia, and the Romans panicked. Rome was not quite the big power it was. They were fierce, they were respected, but they were not quite the big power they were. The Gauls invaded Italy, and the Romans went out to meet them at the Allia River, and they were surprised by the number. They didn't realize the Gauls had this big of an army. And the Romans got beat pretty bad, and they panicked, and they raced back to Rome, and they were in such a panic, they didn't lock all the city gates. They left the city gates open. And in ancient Rome, the early city, when it was a little smaller, they had a little fortress inside the city that they built on the Capitoline Hill. And so they just immediately, they didn't even try to defend the city gates, they just all rushed into the fortress and locked it all up. It was real secure. And the Gauls came storming after them. And it's kind of an interesting point in itself, because the Gauls stopped at the city gates. They saw the city gates were left open and there was no guards or anything, and they thought, that's a trick. That's the trick right there. We know these Romans. And so the Gauls sat there for two whole days just kind of waiting for something to happen. You're not going to get us that easily. And they finally realized, wait a minute, they're just scared, aren't they? And so they finally went into the city and they saw that all the Romans had retreated into their fortress on the Capitoline. And so then they started to besiege the fortress. Well, the Romans had a secret entrance hidden to their little fortress so that they could send messengers in and out and so they'd get food in and out. And the Gauls spotted a messenger one night leaving from the secret entrance, so they figured out where the secret entrance was. And the secret entrance was guarded by dogs. And so they decided a plan. The Gauls were a sneaky bunch, and so they figured out a plan that they just needed to move real quietly and it wouldn't disturb the dogs. Did I mention the Gauls lived in what is today is called France, just to give you a little background opinion on there. The Gauls snuck past the dogs. The dogs just snoozing away, and they were right up to this entrance. Well, they had to go past the Temple of Juno. Juno was the Roman queen of the gods, and Juno liked animals, but especially birds, and she was especially fond of geese. And they always kept, in the Temple of Juno, they always kept a flock of geese, because Juno was supposed to have liked geese. And so these geese started to kick up a ruckus, as only geese can. Right. They saw these people they didn't know sneaking in at night, bothering them, and so the geese started making a lot of racket, and they started flinging themselves at these Gauls. And the Gauls were slowed down by these geese. Well, we could have dealt with dogs. You know, we know how to deal with dogs. What is this? They're not supposed to attack us. And the racket woke up the Romans and gave them just enough time to organize a defense. And so they held out then until help could arrive from somebody else. And so the geese saved Rome. And for many centuries afterwards, geese were very popular guard animals. They're actually very good guard animals. Yeah. They have much better hearing than dogs do. They have much sharper eyesight than dogs do. And they're very territorial, as you know, if you've ever approached one during nesting season. And so geese actually are still used in large parts of the world as guard animals. I was reading an article not long ago about China, where in rural China, they're used as guard animals. And even a lot of the police stations in rural China use geese to guard them because the geese are better than dogs. They make a bigger noise, they're a lot more sensitive, and they're very territorial. If they think you're part of their flock, they will protect you. They'll give their lives for you. If they adopt you as part of their flock, they will do that. And it's interesting because the Romans decided that they were actually much more effective than a lot of much more ferocious animals. Geese actually, if you're not afraid of it, you just stand there and let it do its worst, it actually really can't hurt you. You know, they're pacifists, they don't carry around weapons or anything like that. They're actually not going to, they don't have any sharp edges or anything like that. But they tend to, they're very brave and they're very aggressive, and so they frighten people off and they can be very effective. And it's kind of interesting because the goose, in a sense, is a parallel for the warning system God gives us. You see, we tend to react to the world's warning systems, the panic, the anger, the hatred, the rivalries that they want to instill in us. God gives us a gentler warning system. Just the fact that you sometimes know something's not right. The fact that you just realize your desires are not what they should be. It's a goose warning system, if you will. Just reminding you, instead of trying to use force, instead of resorting to the world's weapons, just readjust your perspective on this thing. Take a closer look. Look beyond the appearances. As Jesus said in John, you're looking only on the surface of things. Don't judge by just appearances. As Isaiah said, don't judge by mere appearances. Look at the real needs out there. Look at the real things out there. And that's what this passage in Proverbs has been about. Adjusting our view on our neighbors, people in various positions in life, and our relationships. Learning a little self-control, a little grace. Learning to look at these things the way God wants us to look at instead of the way that the worldly tend to use each other and look at each other. Thanks a lot for your patient attention, and we shall do some more Proverbs next week.